Today is January 24th, 2009, and this is the Apple Weekly Report, episode number 140, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor for TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, another editor. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/AWR. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at awr@macobserver.com. Oh, and you can find me on Twitter, which is funny because Twitter just went off in my headphones, which is what was making me pause. I'm at TMO Brian. That's Brian with a Y.
And you can find me on Twitter also. I'm J Gamet. That's J G A M E T. And I did not have my little Twitter chirps go off in my ear, but since you remembered, well, that's good enough for me.
It was someone actually poking fun at us for the name Weekly in the podcast.
Well, you know, this term Weekly, we use it kind of loosely.
We do. But we're actually going to make some slight changes in the way we position the podcast. There really is not going to be much change in the format or content of the show, but we are working on some changes that we think will make a lot more sense for a lot more people and just better position us.
Sounds good to me. I can't wait.
Yeah, fair enough. So let's do it.
Sounds good to me.
Can't wait.
That'll be swell. Apple's first quarter earnings came in above analyst estimates. COO Tim Cook offered up his vision for Apple's future. The SEC is taking a look at how the company revealed Steve Jobs' health issues, and Apple agreed to a $22 million settlement over scratched iPods. Google's Android Marketplace topped 800 apps. Apple quietly bumped the specs for the white MacBook, and the Mac turned 25.
Oh, yay! Happy birthday, Mac!
Happy birthday!
Happy birthday!
Yay!
Oh, what a nice cake.
I like cake.
Apple turned in a better-than-expected December quarter, reporting earnings of $1.78 U.S. per share on a net profit of $1.6 billion, well ahead of the consensus estimates between $1.29 to $1.39 in profits per share. Boy, I didn't say that very well. The company reported revenue of $10.1 billion ahead of the $9.75 billion that Wall Street expected, and this not only marked the first time the company topped $10 billion in revenue, it was also, and therefore, yet another record quarter for the company. Apple sold 2.524 million Macs during the quarter, a 9% year-over-year gain, and a record 22.7 million iPods, which represents 3% year-over-year unit growth. The company sold 4.36 million iPhones, representing an 88% year-over-year unit growth, though it was a drop from the 6.5 million units sold in the prior quarter. Shares in the company leapt higher in the after-hours market and maintained those gains through the rest of the week. The stock closed on Friday at $88.36 per share, an 11.8% gain off its lows Wednesday morning before the company made its announcement, and I should, for the sake of disclosure, mention that I have, like, the world's tiniest holdings in Apple ever.
But still bigger than mine because I have none.
Fair enough.
Apple COO Tim Cook, the company's acting CEO, while Steve Jobs is on medical leave of absence, laid out his company's manifesto for what it does, why it does it, and how it will be done, telling financial analysts that Apple will continue to be a great company no matter who is at the helm. Mr. Cook's response can only be described as a manifesto, or perhaps a credo, intended to explain to investors and analysts alike that the company's management feels Apple will continue to do well no matter who is CEO, and more specifically, with or without Steve Jobs. Mr. Cook claimed that the culture at Apple was entrenched with the ideas of innovating and making great products, and he specified some core values of what the company will and won't do, and we'll read his comments in full in the context machine.
Apple may have fallen under the watchful eye of the Security and Exchange Commission for potentially misleading investors with information, or the lack thereof, about the health of Steve Jobs. The agency is apparently looking into the matter, even though there may not be any evidence of wrongdoing, according to unnamed sources close to the matter. James Cox, a Duke University law professor, commented, quote, "It's not surprising for the SEC to come in and look afterward, given the pressure and publicity regarding their handling of a lot of cases," unquote. The likelihood that the SEC could or would bring charges against Apple in this case isn't great unless the agency can show that the company, that's Apple, planned to benefit by intentionally withholding concrete information on the CEO's health. For now, it appears that the SEC investigation is merely routine and that there currently isn't any indication of wrongdoing on Apple's part.
And Apple's ongoing headache over first-generation iPod Nanos with scratched displays appears to be coming to an end now that a $22.5 million settlement in a related class action lawsuit has been reached. The settlement gives qualifying first-generation iPod Nano owners up to $25, but doesn't require Apple to admit any wrongdoing. The class action suit was filed shortly after the original iPod Nano was released, and many owners found that the glossy front surface of the device scratched too easily. The suit claimed that Apple misled buyers because it knew the digital media player scratched easily, but failed to disclose that information. iPod Nano owners hoping to participate in the settlement must complete a claim form by June 10, 2009.
And we have links to that on the site. Is that correct?
We certainly do.
We certainly do. So check the show notes for links to the article and forums in question, etc.
Right.
Google announced during its fourth quarter earnings conference call that there were now some 800 apps available at the Android Marketplace, which is Google's analog to Apple's App Store for iPhone and iPod Touch applications. That is substantially higher than the 500 apps that were available in December, but it doesn't exactly make Android the 800-pound gorilla in the room, considering it's rather far behind the 15,000 apps available at the App Store. In fact, VentureBeat described it as, quote-unquote, laughably far behind, though, of course, your mileage may vary.
Apple quietly updated the specs for its $999 entry-level MacBook this week to more closely match the features of its unibody siblings. The updated model now sports a 2 GHz Core 2 Duo processor, 2 GB of RAM, and an NVIDIA GeForce. Excuse me. Apparently my secret medicine isn't working as well as I thought to suppress my cough. All right. It has 2 GB of RAM, an NVIDIA GeForce 9400M video processor, and the updated laptop keeps its white plastic body instead of switching to the metal unibody construction found on Apple's other laptop models. It also keeps its FireWire 400 port, a feature that was dropped from the unibody MacBook design.
Oh, boy, they don't seem to like that, do they?
Yeah, apparently our studio audience is not happy with that.
Go on. Wow, that's nasty. <I tell you. laughs> you know, the one question I had from that, Jeff, is that the price is still $999, right?
Yes, it is.
You had addressed that quite well. The Macintosh turned 25 this week, which means Apple's computer line is not only old enough to drive, vote, and drink, it also now qualifies for lower insurance rates. In fact, it looks like this Mac thing may even catch on and stick around for a while. What do you think?
It's a fad. I don't know. We'll see. You know, it's like pockets on pants. I don't know. It might catch on. It might not.
It might not. It may. The reality, despite all the naysayers, doom criers, and Rob Enderleys of the world, is that the Mac has continually managed to introduce features that have worked their way into other aspects of our computing business and personal lives. Going back to 1984, the first Mac shipped with an 8 megahertz Motorola 68000 processor, also known as the 68K processor, 128K of RAM, and a 400K floppy drive. 25 years later, the Mac Pro ships with two 2.8 gigahertz Intel quad-core Xeon processors, 2 gigs of RAM and a 320 gig hard drive for $2,799. Now, that original 128K Mac set users back $2,495. The changes Apple set in motion 25 years ago when it introduced the Mac have had a profound impact on the computer world and end users alike. And here, Jeff, is to another 25 years of game-changing innovation from Apple, be it with the Mac or its eventual successor.
Indeed. I'm actually toasting with my secret cough medicine recipe right now.
Yeah, mine is called Dasani water.
Oh, well, mine actually is called Jameson because the Maker's Mark was gone.
To the context machine. All right, that sound means it's time for the context machine. That's where Jeff and I delve a little more deeply into the news to provide context for what's going on. Should we do the birthday? Well, no, we're doing that last.
You know, this is our show. We can do it in any order we want. So
I often like doing the last news article because it's fresh.
All right, first. Well, then let's start with Apple's birthday or the Apple's Mac's birthday.
Happy birthday!
Happy birthday.
You know, it's funny, the Mac, you look at its history, and, you know, I saw what a lot of people were doing on Twitter was recounting the first time they'd encountered a Mac.
They were, and I actually didn't jump in on that one simply because, I was being lazy, sorry.
I wrote a column about it, like, years ago, so I didn't feel the need to jump in either.
You know, and my first Mac, as it turns out, was actually a Quadra 610 with the DOS compatible card in it. And the reason I waited so long to get into the Mac was because when it was time to replace my Apple IIe, I could buy a Mac or I could buy an Apple IIgs, which let me run GS software plus all the Apple software that I already owned. And it gave me color, which is something I didn't get with the Mac at the time. So sure. It made sense for me to buy an Apple IIgs. And yes, mine even had the WAS signature on the front. That's how hip I was back then. Oh, yeah, wicked fast.
Wicked fast. Well, my first Mac to use was, I think, a 2SI, actually, at a Kinko's.
Oh, nice.
That was my first one to use. I was blown away with it. My first one to own was the Power 100, which was basically Power Computing's first entry into the clone market.
Right. I loved Power Computing's slogan, "Let's kick Intel's ass."
Yeah, well, you know, they did just about everything right, which is why Apple had to put them out of business.
Yeah, that's true. So, all right, so your first Mac was substantially older than my first Mac. However, I do now have a fully working Mac Plus sitting in the corner. I can actually see it from my desk right now.
You know, I finally got rid of all of the old Macs that I've got.
That's the only old one I kept. I couldn't bring myself to get rid of the Mac Plus.
I do have 2 20th anniversary Macs that I need to sell.
Okay, those are actually pretty cool.
They're freaking cool. Actually, you know, from an industrial design standpoint, they stand up to anything that's on the market today, including anything that Apple makes. I mean, you know, it's certainly in a different way, but it's funny how well those things have aged from an industrial design standpoint.
Yeah, I think they still look good, there we go. I just validated what you said.
Right. And, you know, I think another interesting point along the history of the Mac that we should talk about is Steve Jobs saying that he felt like Apple should basically milk the Mac for all it's got for all it's worth for another couple of years before moving on to something else.
I'm glad they haven't moved on yet. Yes, I do remember that, actually.
But that's just it. They did exactly that. They moved on to Mac OS X.
Well, you're right. And what I was visualizing when he said that was something completely different from what the Mac was. And, well, to a degree, Mac OS X is exactly that. But I was thinking like some other, like a brand new computing platform, hardware and software. They did that. All right, never mind.
It's funny, you know, those words came from Steve Jobs before Next was bought. It's when they were when if I remember correctly, and I didn't research this before we started recording the show, so I'm totally going off memory here. But I believe that it came when Apple was still looking at buying B, before Ellen Hancock, whom Steve Jobs eventually dismissed, said that they should talk to Next.
Well, she was right.
Yeah, she was totally right.
But you know, I really liked B. I thought it was pretty cool at the time.
B was doing some really, really cool things at the time. I think that, who knows where things would have gone, but I think that that for Apple and its shareholders and for the Mac platform or the Mac OS X platform, depending on how you want to count it, that the choice to go with Steve Jobs and Next was probably the better choice.
I
think that I don't think that Apple would be the incredibly well-run company it is today if Jean-Louis Gasset had taken over the company. And that's with all due respect for what he did with B and everything else. But I think that it's turned out that, ironically, considering how bad a manager Steve Jobs was at the end of his first tenure, or his first term at Apple,
right,
that he has proven to be a dynamite manager.
He has. And, you're right. That's actually... Excuse me, that's actually kind of surprising. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that he's been able to gather together the people that he needs to create that strong management team.
But that's part of his management.
Right.
He's not only identified who he wanted, he got them. He gave them the power they needed without micromanaging or unmicromanaging striking that balance. And he's able to keep this talented team together. I mean, and all of all those things are not traits that he had one way or another when he was first at Apple.
You know, maybe he needed to get kicked out so he could go find his way.
Well,
I don't know.
I think that may well be the case. I think that may well that definitely may well be the case. But let's get back to the Mac. So you've got the original Mac, and then you've got the Power Macs, and then you've got the iMac, and you've got the iMacs of today, and this platform, including its de facto changes from the original Mac to Mac OS X, it's amazing where we are today.
Actually, it really is, and I have to say we are not where I thought we would be, and apparently, I'm at some point going to have to get more of my secret cough medicine because it's just not working right. But we're not where I thought we would be, because I was assuming that when Apple made the transition from the 68,000 series processors into the PowerPC processor, that they had found the new way, and that moving from the CISC type processor to a RISC type processor was going to be the thing that totally propelled Apple above and beyond everyone else. And of course, at the time, I was naive enough to not take into consideration politics inside the companies. And, so then there's the whole Motorola IBM split thing. And so I wasn't expecting Apple would ever end up in the Intel camp. Mm-hmm. And when they first announced that's where they were going, I was kind of nervous about that. But I think they really did make the right choice.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, yeah. I think that where we are today is from the standpoint of Mac users. I think that where we are today is it's better than it's ever been.
Oh, I agree.
The platform. There's no question whatsoever about the health of the platform. You know, and that used to be all we talked about. You look at our site. You look at the Mac Observer. You look at Macadon. You look at Mac Central that was eventually bought by Macworld. The other websites that are out there, and we were all founded in an era when a big part of what made us possible was people being concerned about Apple's future.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's gone now. Analysts have to really, really, really reach deep inside their sphincters to come out with anything close to Apple's clearly about to fail. I mean, the company is doing $35 billion? $34 billion?
It's higher than I can count.
It's just enormous. And, you know, more Macs now being sold than ever. This last quarter did see a market share drop from the prior quarter, but it was a market share gain over the year before. And Apple right. usually has that September quarter to December quarter market share drop, by the way. That's actually not an unusual thing. Lots of back-to-school purchases and stuff going on in the September quarter. So, I mean, just, you know, the Mac platform is healthy. It's healthy as can be. We have a ton of developers. This last Macworld was the biggest Macworld we've seen in years. You know, and iLounge is going to do what they can to kill it, but that's another story. you know, just it's a good time to be a Mac user.
It is, and you know, I'm going to jump back to the iLounge thing for a second. Now that you brought it up, dude, you totally opened that door.
I did. I did it on purpose. I did it just to wind you up and watch you go.
All right. So for people that aren't up to speed on what's going on, iLounge, that's a news website that is dedicated primarily to iPod and iPhone related news. They have. I'm going to try and be nice about all this. We'll see how long that lasts. All right, so what they have done is I'm doing air quotes, collaborated to create a pavilion at CES, which is the trade show that goes alongside Macworld Expo time-wise, so that companies can go there instead of Macworld Expo. And they're doing this under the auspices of, hey, we're trying to come up with this great way for companies to be able to get their products in front of more people. All right, so to cut to the chase, I think it's actually a total crock. I think what iLounge is doing is trying to turn themselves into a hub for vendors as opposed to a news site. So, you know, it's not so much the news aspect that they're going for with all this. It's more of the, we want to find a way to be involved in generating more revenue, and this is a way we can do it. And I think they're misleading a lot of vendors that are considering making the jump to CES.
Well, they're misleading readers what they're doing too.
Oh, clearly, because they're presenting themselves in this altruistic way, and I don't think that's what they're really doing. And I think that this is all about finding a new revenue stream for themselves. And unfortunately, I think what they're going to do is end up hurting other vendors and Macworld Expo at the same time.
And we should probably be a little more descriptive of what they're actually doing. So they're basically, as Jeff said, they've collaborated with CEA. That's the company that owns CES. And there's going to be an iLounge pavilion where iPod and iPhone related vendors can basically all be gathered together. So they're probably making money from that. We don't know because they're not telling.
Right.
And yeah, that's an important thing. And they were smack talking Macworld right after, like basically starting during the show itself. They started talking smack about Macworld Expo.
Right. They actually wrote some articles that did that too. Yeah.
Yeah, about how people were unhappy with it. They were circulating letters saying that, you know, asking vendors whether or not they were unhappy with Macworld, all without saying, of course, that they were actually working with CEA to begin with. So, you know, it's dodgy to use the British term. The whole thing, their presentation is dodgy, their setup is dodgy, the arrangement is dodgy, and their upfrontness is lacking. And you know, by and large, if they pull away a bunch of iPod case vendors from Macworld, that's no loss.
Okay, yes, there is that. So in that sense, they're doing a service.
Yeah, but you know, the idea, the funny thing about CES, what a lot of people don't even realize is that CES is not a consumer show. It's not open to the public. You cannot get in unless you're press or industry, period.
Right, and so if you look at the people that iLounge is likely to draw away from Macworld and get into CES, these are the people that are going to suddenly be in front of the wrong audience, because they need to be talking to the end users, the actual consumers that are buying their product.
They Some don't of need them, to, yeah.
Right. And, but at CES, the group that they're primarily going to be in front of will be the people that buy products to distribute other places.
Yeah, they're retailers, they're distributors, and they're OEMs, and they're press. That's by and large. I mean, and that, I may be leaving out some little niche group here or there, but well, that's
they totally dig the bloggers. So there'll be bloggers there too.
Right, yeah, because they, yeah, unlike Apple, CES has done a good job of reaching out to bloggers, but that's another point. And, you know, a lot of the people that show at Macworld, like, for instance, people with little iPhone apps and people with small Mac apps, you know, they need to be in front of people and press. They don't need to be in front of retailers. And I think that's true with a lot of people at Macworld. And my only problem here is that I think that iLounge could have done what they've done without talking smack about Macworld. And I think they could have done it in a way that didn't have to have much of an impact on Macworld.
There's two things that I don't like about the way this has played out, which means that on this level, you're actually far more forgiving than I am. And so that's saying a lot. All right, so the first thing I don't like is that they started talking smack about Macworld. And I don't have a problem with people not being happy with Macworld, because
of course not.
Everyone has a different perspective on how events go. But it felt to me like that was posturing so that they could make this other thing they're doing look better. Yes. So in that sense, they're presenting information as news when it felt to me like it was a very calculated spin. Exactly.
Yep.
The other thing that I don't like is that this all started off in a very cloak and dagger, under the table kind of way, or at least that's how it appeared to me, with messages going out to companies with notes in there saying, don't tell anyone about this. But then when they started talking about it, they're talking about it like they're being open and above board on all of this. But then there's this other thing that's already been happening. So they've set up an air where it's difficult for people to now trust what they're saying about all this. And I'm not happy with that.
Right. And again, I'm happy as can be that they've been able to work this out with CEA, that they're going to do an iLounge pavilion. That's meant more power to them. iLounge has done a lot of really, really good things business-wise. They are a huge site. They've had a lot of success. They do a lot of things right. And I'm fine with that. I am fine with there being an iLounge pavilion of iPod case developer, you know, case makers and you know, whomever else might actually be there. I am not fine with damaging Macworld, because Macworld is still important to the Mac world.
It is. You're absolutely right.
And I just, again, they just didn't have to, try and deliberately hurt Macworld in the process of actually doing their iLaunch pavilion. They didn't have to, and they chose to take that path. And if they were to succeed and they were to pull enough people away from Macworld to actually kill it, which I don't think they can do, well, who benefits? And the answer is iLaunch, no one else. Because the Mac world is not going to benefit, the iPod world is not going to benefit, their readers aren't going to benefit, no one else is going to benefit from the dissolution of Macworld Expo, because Macworld Expo is, quite frankly, still going to be an important show for a lot of companies. There are a lot of companies where CES just isn't going to do jack squat for them.
Yeah.
And those companies need Macworld. Some companies need CES, some companies need Macworld. Quite frankly, more companies need Macworld, in my opinion.
You know, another important thing for people to take a look at is that CES and Macworld are very, very different events, and they're catering to very different demographics, meaning Macworld is catering to end users in the media, and probably in the future, bloggers to a bigger extent, too. CES, which you pointed out, caters to the industry side of things. Mm-hmm. And there are so many things that don't happen at CES that do at Macworld, which is not to say there's problems with CES. It's simply that these are different events.
It's a different show.
Right.
It's a different kind of show. As a matter of fact, they are largely complementary shows.
They are. I wish that they didn't overlap, because it would be much easier to look at the two shows as their own thing, as opposed to competing events, because they're not competing events.
Let's move macro back to September. Paul, are you listening?
Well, okay, before
September
I agree
and
with
CES
that.
In January.
Okay, before I agree with Macworld in September, remind me again, what is the weather like in San Francisco in September?
It's fine.
Okay, then September it is.
It's even better than it is in January.
Okay, then I'm totally fine with September.
I mean, the weather in the Bay Area is fine all frickin' year long.
That's true.
So, yeah, anyway. I don't know how we – well, I do know how we got off on it.
Yeah, you totally set me up so I'd go off. That's how we got on this.
Yeah, we're probably going to be doing some coverage on this as we've been putting facts together. And by we, largely Jeff has been putting facts together for some time on this. And we anticipate doing some coverage at the site in print in the relatively near future.
That's a totally safe thing to say. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, anyway, Macworld big. Mac user big, Mac platform big, developers doing well, more developers on the platform. It's a good time to be a Mac user. It's been a good 25 years, despite some of the pitfalls, despite the Power Mac 4400, despite the Performaline, which Adam didn't mention the Performaline, despite the Clone Wars and the nastiness of the Clone Wars, Spindler. What's his name? But Mike Iron Man, Iron Horse. Not Schindler. What is his name? Are you leaving me hanging here, or are you trying to remember
too? I can't stop laughing. It was Michael Spindler.
Spindler. Okay, I got it right the first time. So, you know, despite Michael Spindler, despite the Knowledge Navigator... despite the angst and turmoil of ending the Newton, you know, despite all of these things, hockey puck mouse.
Okay, the hockey puck mouse, that totally sucked. The message pad, dude, mine still works.
Yeah, well, I've got one that works too.
Okay, what model do you have?
We've got the 2100.
Oh, man. Everyone's got a better one than I do. I have the 130, which is still a good one.
130 is still a good one, man.
Yeah.
Still a good one.
Yeah.
So anyway, despite all these things, it's been a good 25 years to be a Mac user. And, you know, it's funny. The Mac OS and Mac OS 10 still kick Windows ass.
Yes, they do.
Just saying. All right. Before we get on to the thing I'm really looking forward to chatting about, which is... Tim Cook's manifesto, we should mention our sponsor, Smile on My Mac.
Oh, that's right. I totally forgot. We jumped to the end, and I was thinking, holy crap, how did we get through the context machine so quickly? It's because we didn't. We're going backwards.
Yes.
All right, so yes, this week's sponsor is Smile on My Mac, and I totally love those guys. I'm just going to come right out and say it. I am in love with Smile on My Mac.
Yeah, we say it all the time, fortunately. And, you know, Smile on My Mac won an Editor's Choice Award this year.
They did. They won for PDF Pen 4. And it was.
And that has nothing to do with the fact that they're sponsors. As a matter of fact, Jeff and I mean, and we mean this as sincerely as we possibly can be, the fact that we can have someone like Smile on My Mac that would win an Editor's Choice Award from the Mac Observer at Macworld Expo for a product as great as PDF Pen Pro makes us lucky, lucky podcasters.
It really does. So for those of you that aren't familiar with PDF Pen Pro, and it really is an amazing product. All right, so if you deal with PDF files on a regular basis where you have to do more than just read them, it can be a pain in the ass to have to make changes to a PDF, put PDFs together, like multiple PDFs, build forms and all that, if you have to use Adobe Acrobat Pro. And there's nothing wrong with that application, but for most people, I mean, holy crap, it's really overkill. PDF Pen fits that part of the market, which is pretty much all of us, that needs something that's easy to use to manipulate PDF files, isn't going to cost a fortune, and isn't going to have a steep learning curve. I actually use PDF Pen Pro all the time because I'm regularly getting forms as PDF that I need to send back with signatures and other information on them. even though I have Creative Suite 4 on my computer, I end up using PDF Pen to do all of that PDF manipulation. And it's actually lighter, faster,
and easier to use.
Yeah. And the fact that I use PDF Pen all the time is actually saying a lot, because keep in mind, I come from the graphic design world where you rely on Adobe's tools for everything, and you know we're supposed to thumb our noses at other products. But man, PDF Pen, that's a great product to be using. You're right, it's lightweight, it's fast, it's very stable. It's a great product.
It is, and we thank them for their sponsorship. They've been really good to us, and we would like you to check them out at smileonmymac.com. PDF Pen, PDF Pen Pro, I think they list for, what, $48.95
and about $100 for PDF Pen Pro.
Exactly. And you know, they've got some other great products too, but it was PDF Pen Pro that won an Editor's Choice Award. And can you give the really short version of why it is that they won an Editor's Choice Award?
They won because they've added in some amazing new features, like, you know, have optical character recognition in there. They improved the tools that let you hook together PDF files. Those are the two quick things right there. But what they did was they took a tool that last year was amazing, and then they really kicked it up a notch this year and made it so much better that it really ended up standing head and shoulders above the other PDF manipulation tools that we've seen out there.
Yeah, and we very specifically don't talk about our voting process, but PDF Pen Pro was like probably the shortest deliberation of most of the products that ended up winning the award.
I think you're right.
All right, as I choke.
Apparently my cough is contagious. It's now made it all its own way through the interwebs over to your end of the world. Sorry about that.
The tubes in the dump truck. So
yeah, they just dumped my cough on you. Sorry.
Yeah. So on that note, another thing I wanted to briefly talk about, or like we can make this very brief, because I just think there's a very specific point to make, and that's the Google Android Marketplace hitting 800 apps, you know, and how that's kind of like, you know, ha ha ha, because the iPhone has got 15,000 apps.
Right, but Google hitting 800 apps, that's 300 more than Apple started with at the App Store.
Yeah, and they're way behind, and they're probably never going to catch up. But there's an important thing to remember, and that's that when the App Store launched with 500 apps, everybody was blown away. And it was just like considered a huge success right off the bat. Like, oh my God, they've got 500 apps, and you know it's just launched.
Well, and, Apple yeah, set the bar.
Right.
Right, and especially because there was nothing like the App Store before there was the App Store. So the fact that Apple could take something that simply did not exist, generate enough interest in it that they could launch with 500 applications, I mean, wow.
Right, but it was considered viable. And that's my point. It was considered a success. It was considered viable with 500 apps. So Google has hit 800 apps, and that is a lot of applications, and they're all free. And that's actually a point that we didn't make in the news part of this. I think it was Information Week made the point that a big part of Google's problem is the fact that they can't make any money. They can't charge. They don't have a charging mechanism for developers to be able to charge at the Android marketplace.
Okay, so my question is, how could Google, I mean, these are smart people, how could they create a system for distributing applications for their Android platform that didn't take into account that people might want to charge for their programs? I mean, it's not like selling your software is a new concept.
Well, you know, Google is obsessed with everything being free/advertiser supported. So, you know, they probably just weren't even thinking about it at all. It should be something that should be very easily rectifiable. They should be able to fix this. But that said, I'm not like some kind of Android expert, and there may actually be some kind of, you know, like, because Apple uses the iTunes Store and the DRM system that they put in place for music. You know, that's how they're controlling what goes on to an Android phone, whereas Android is very specifically open to any and all comers. So, you know, charging for an app may be kind of pointless in that it might be just instantly pirated too. So, you know, but when you compare it, like, I kind of made it to be poignant. I the reason why I mentioned this, and I hate to have anything dealing with iFart Mobile pretend to be poignant, but, you know, we ran that story right after Christmas about how iFart Mobile had brought in $113,000 in the, basically, I think it was like the 2 weeks leading up to Christmas. You know, so that developer, after the developer's cut, you know, he made $80,000 off of a fart application. And you know, the guys developing for Google, they can't make anything.
No,
so is it any surprise the developers are flocking to iPhone?
Well, right. And then considering that you can make money off of applications like iFart Mobile. Okay, I want to take a small step back here. iFart Mobile, are they implying that there's an iFart desktop version too?
The name does, the you know, maybe that's coming. I don't really know.
I hope not.
I hope not too. Yeah, I don't really care for all the fart applications on iPhones. But, you know, who can blame these guys that are wanting to make money? Anyway, be that as it may, I don't think that you should write off Android because they only have 800 apps. That's my point.
Right. I wouldn't write them off. However, I would not expect them to overtake Apple in the App Store.
Not with everything as it is today. It's going to take some kind of major change, be it from Apple and Google or both, before that could possibly happen. But that's really all I wanted to say on that.
All right, I have a little more to say on that.
Okay.
All right. So I think that the Google Android marketplace will always have a hard time keeping up with Apple's App Store, if for no other reason, assuming that they find a way so that developers can charge for their apps. But if for no other reason than the fact that with Apple, we still go back to the thing where they control the whole thing. I mean, they control the App Store. They control the actual hardware that all of this runs on. Whereas with Google Android, you end up in the same type of boat that you have with Windows and the PC market, which is anyone can make their own hardware, and now you start running into compatibility issues. And so I think that there's going to be just enough going on with compatibility problems that people will find it easier in the long run to write for the App Store than for the Android marketplace.
Yep, I would agree with that.
Okay, now I'm done and we can move on.
All right. I agree. So I mean, yay. Hooray.
Go us.
Go us. So last thing I want to talk about in this episode of the Apple Weekly Report is the manifesto, the credo from Tim Cook.
You know, considering that I said we would read it in the context machine, I think you should read it.
I will read it. And I got to tell you, this stuff, I hope to write a column on this. Tim Cook single-handedly almost turned me back into an Apple fanboy. Almost. He didn't by any stretch, but he almost did.
And for those of you that aren't in the know, that's saying a lot.
So this is what he said, and this whole little thing that he clearly read came in response to someone asking about Steve Jobs. I think it was Ben Reitzes, the Barclays analyst, who was the first analyst to go, and he just said, "Well, I'm first. I guess I might as well ask it. How's Steve doing?" You know, knowing of course that he's not going to get an answer, but that he was pretty much obligated to ask it. And right. Peter Oppenheimer basically blew the guy off, right?
Right.
But, you know, Steve serves as the CEO, and you know, and that's all there is to it. We're not going to say anything else. And then Tim Cook said, "Well, let me back up a minute." And then he launched into this, and I'm quoting. And this will be a little bit long. "There is an extraordinary breadth and depth in our more than 35,000 employees who are all wicked smart. And that's in all areas of the company, from engineering to marketing, operations and sales, and all the rest. The values of our company are extremely well entrenched. We believe that we're on the face of the earth to make great products, and that's not changing. We're constantly focusing on innovating. We believe in the simple, not the complex. We believe we need to own and control the primary technologies behind the products that we make and participate only in markets where we can make a significant contribution. We believe in saying no to thousands of projects so that we can focus on the few that are meaningful to us. We believe in deep collaboration and cross-pollination in order to innovate in a way others cannot. We don't settle for anything other than excellence in any group in the company, and we have the self-honesty to admit when we're wrong and the courage to change. Regardless of who is in what job, those values are so embedded in this company that Apple will do extremely well. And I would just iterate a point Peter made in his opening comments. Actually, Tim said reiterate, and he was iterating it, not reiterating. But that's just a pet peeve. I strongly believe that Apple is doing the best work in its history. So part of this message was aimed at Wall Street. Part of this message was to saying to Wall Street, it doesn't matter who's in charge, this company is solid, that the management's solid, that everybody in the company basically is doing a kick-ass job, and that no single person is responsible for the success of the company. That's part of what he was trying to say, right?
Right.
But the part that just really, 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 really hit me, that I enjoyed hearing so much, was, first of all, him iterating Apple's policy of controlling and owning the primary technologies. In other words, they're not going to take Microsoft's licensing approach, that they're committed to that. That this whole thing of how we believe in saying no to thousands of projects so that they can concentrate on a few, that to me was just you know, it was just fantastic to hear. And that they don't settle for anything other than excellence in any group in the company. I mean, that's huge. I mean, you look at every other company that's out there, most every other company that's out there, and, you know, just so that's just not true for most of them. It's just not true. And it's why Apple makes such great products, and it's why I was so attracted to Apple products, you know, going back years ago. It's why I wanted to launch the Mac. It's why I bought Webintosh from Dan Hughes, and it's why I asked Dave Hamilton to take half the company. Actually, he bought half the company, but, you know, to be my business partner in this, because I needed the help from the business side, because I wanted to cover Apple. And that's going back 10 years ago. And, you know, a lot of the reasons why I got into covering Apple and writing about Apple and talking about Apple is because of some of these core values that Tim Cook made. And I just, it was freaking great hearing it.
I thought it was a great speech. And I thought that he did a really, really good job of laying everything out on the line so people know exactly where Apple stands and exactly how the management team will be working moving forward with or without Steve Jobs. And I think it was a very important speech for him to make, and it was made at exactly the right time.
Mm-hmm. And it may well have been part of that rally that we mentioned. I'm not really sure. I don't know. You know, it's interesting. The article that I did on this, I thought it was an interesting article. I thought that these points were just super important, and we got only two comments on it, which is I expected dozens. And, you know, one of them was a smart-ass comment from long-term reader Bosco, who often likes to stir the pot. And then one person who said that he agreed with some of the things I was saying. But, you know, it just, I don't know, maybe this slipped under the radar of a lot of people. But to me, that speech is about... It comes from the exact same place on why the Mac is a great computer to use, why Mac OS X is a great operating system to use, why the iPhone is a great phone to use, and why the iPod works.
Yeah, it is. And yeah, what it did for me was drive home the point that Apple is still focused. Excuse me, regardless of whether or not Steve Jobs is in his office or in his house, that the company's focus is still there and it's not going to go away.
Right. Yeah, well said. Well said. Well said. And that's the context machine.
Oh, yeah, I guess it really is the context machine now. See, you had me all backwards because, well,
I'm sorry.
That's all right. Semper Gumby.
Hey, do you know who I want to bring on as a sponsor?
Who?
Cultured Code, the guys that make things.
That would be a cool sponsor to have.
An additional sponsor to the great folks at Smile on My Mac. Right. I love things. Things is such a great product. I'm gonna talk to them. They should sponsor us, because I just, there'd be another great company that I'd be pretty proud to have sponsor us.
Okay, Things is very cool, and I have to say, when I started playing with Things and did the whole setup so that I was syncing between my computer and my iPhone, and all I had to do was click a button and it was done. Mm-hmm. Holy crap, that's so smart.
You know, on Things, you don't have to click any button. You actually, if Things is launched on your iPhone, it does an automatic syncing if it's on the same network as your computer.
Well, I mean for the initial setup.
Oh, for the initial, right.
But you're now, right. The syncing is automatic.
No, I know you're actually a fan of OmniFocus.
Right.
Another great Mac and iPhone combination.
Yeah.
So not talking smack about those boys either.
No, actually, anyway, it was a tough decision for me which way to go.
Well, you were already on OmniFocus, I think, before Things for iPhone was announced.
Right. So had both been out at the same time, it would have been difficult for me to decide which way to go. But I was already deeply entrenched in OmniFocus when Things really started to come into its own, and then they finally got the iPhone app, and I was already using the OmniFocus on the iPhone. So, you know, but I did sit down and take a look for a few minutes and really think about whether or not I should switch.
And they both won Editor's Choice Awards.
Right. So the fact that I actually stopped and thought about whether or not I should be switching to Things,
mm-hmm.
that's saying a lot, because I have OmniFocus running all the time. If my computer is on, OmniFocus is running.
And I'm the least organized person on the planet, and I actually think that Things has already helped me get some things done. So, you know, I'm pretty stoked. Maybe we'll talk about that more maybe in the next show. Maybe we'll do a review of the two or something like that.
I think that sounds great. We should do a smackdown. And in the meantime, we should send them both bills for talking about the products.
I'm sure they'll be pleased with that. Alrighty. So, take us out.
Okay. So, with all that said, if you have anything to comment on, add, or question, send your audio or text comments to awr@macobserver.com. And remember, succinctness is next to steveliness. And that's this week's Apple Weekly Report. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sending us your comments and feedback. And don't forget, you can follow me on Twitter and see what odd things going inside my head. That's twitter.com/jgamut.
And I'm at twitter.com/TMOBrian. That's Brian with a Y. Now, our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer and iPodObserver.com. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. If you're listening to this, it's because of Cashfly. The bass is by Boom. That was recorded just for us, and that's all for this week.
And as always, stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer and iPodObserver.com.